Well, good afternoon, everybody. I hope you've all had a very good afternoon outside, inside, or a combination of the two. So now we come to the presentation by Fritjof Capra. And I actually first met and heard Fritjof in Cambridge in 1978. At a meeting organized at Trinity College by Bernard Carr, no less. And so at that stage, Fritjof had published his book, The Tao of Physics, and it was the same month in which he was speaking at the Mystics and Scientists. And he started talking about the book that followed that one up, which is called The Turning Point, and which I managed to sneak into my Div class at Winchester College, and so I got the bright young things reading and writing essays on Fritjof's book, which was very good. Now Fritjof was at the original Mystics and Scientists. In fact, he was really the keynote speaker at the original Mystics and Scientists. And here, Fritjof, you can see the program. And so he started by speaking on the Tao of Physics at 8:30 on Friday the 14th of April. So that's 39 years ago. And he only got 45 minutes. And then he was followed by Pir Vilayat Khan on the intention behind the dynamics of the universe. And the following day, in the evening, he had another session called The Implication of the New Physics for the Scientific Reality of Our Time. And interestingly, in this year's MSc that I mentioned before, one of the student groups chose that as their focus for their PowerPoint presentation and essays. And they were writing, interestingly, you know, given what Charlotte was talking about this afternoon, about the masculine and the masculine-feminine balance, the East and West, physics and mysticism and so on. Anyway, when I contacted Fritjof a few months ago to say that we were having the 40th conference, he agreed to take part in it, and we've had various interactions since that time. The last time was at a conference together in Italy, where he was talking about Leonardo da Vinci. And I don't know how many of you know that Fritjof has written two books on Leonardo da Vinci, one specifically on Leonardo's science, and they're absolutely fascinating. And then his most recent book is The System's View of Life with Pierluigi Luisi, which is at the back there. And we had a launch for that at Collett House a couple of years ago. And we sold 90 books on the night. And if you haven't got that book in your library, then it's a very important one to have in addition to many of Fritjof's other books. Anyway, Fritjof is joining us from California. And his title is... And somebody will need to give me a program.
No, he can read his
title. His title is Mystics and Scientists in the 21st Century, Science and Spirituality Revisited. So I'd like you to welcome Fritjof to the conference with a resounding round of applause.
Thank you very much.
And Fritjof, I should say one more thing, which you're not necessarily aware of, and that's that we have Malcolm Lazarus here, the initiator of the Mystics and Scientists Conference. He's been
wonderful.
Telling us about...
Come
and say hello, Malcolm. Who initiated these conferences through his initial contact with you, and he's been speaking here... All those many years later.
So nice to see you.
And our discussion will be chaired by Paul Fillmore.
Wonderful. All right, well, good afternoon, everybody. And thank you, David, for this very nice introduction. I'm actually not in California. I'm north of California in Oregon, in Portland, Oregon. And if I were at home, you would see a much nicer background. What you see behind me is a hotel room, but this is where I am. on the west coast of the United States. Well, I'm sorry that I can't be with you physically at this unique anniversary conference, but I'm really happy to be able to share some thoughts with you through this transmission, and I hope that you will be able to hear me all right and see me all right. What I'd like to share with you is my view of the relationship between science and spirituality and how this view has evolved over the last 40 years or so. As you know, I was trained as a physicist, and I spent 20 years from 1965 to 85 doing research in theoretical high energy physics. From my early student years, I was fascinated by the dramatic change of concepts and ideas that happened in physics during the first three decades of the 20th century. At the age of 19, I read a book by Werner Heisenberg, one of the founders of quantum physics, a book that has since become a classic. It is called Physics and Philosophy. And in this book, Heisenberg very vividly describes the experience of a small group of physicists, Niels Bohr, Erwin Schrödinger, Wolfgang Pauli, and Heisenberg himself, who were the first to explore physical phenomena involving atoms and subatomic particles. And this brought them in contact with a strange and unexpected reality. In their struggle to grasp this new reality, those physicists realized very painfully that their basic concepts, their language, their whole way of thinking were inadequate to understand atomic and subatomic phenomena. Their problems were not merely intellectual, but amounted to an intense emotional and you could even say existential crisis. It took them a long time to overcome this crisis, but in the end, they were rewarded with deep insights into the nature of matter and its relationship to the human mind. Now, when I read Heisenberg's book as a young student in Vienna, I probably did not understand more than half of it. But the book stayed with me, it accompanied me during my career as a physicist, and it had a profound impact on my thinking. It prepared the ground for my understanding of the profound change of worldviews or paradigms that is now happening in all fields of science and in society. A change from the mechanistic worldview of Newton and Descartes to a holistic and ecological view. I received my PhD from the University of Vienna in 1966. Then I spent 2 years at the University of Paris, and then I moved to California, to the University of California, where I experienced the so-called counterculture, which was a profound and radical personal transformation for me. It included a deep interest in Eastern spiritual traditions and a very strong sense of empowerment. During that time, I had a unique experience that set me on the road that led to the writing of my first and still best known book, The Tao of Physics. I was sitting by the ocean one late summer afternoon, watching the waves rolling in and paying attention to my breathing as we are taught in meditation, when suddenly I became aware of my whole environment as being involved in a gigantic cosmic dance. Now, being a physicist, I knew that the sand, rocks, water, and air around me were made of molecules and atoms, and that these atoms interacted with one another, and the particles within the atoms interacted with one another by creating and destroying other particles. I also knew that the Earth's atmosphere is continually bombarded by showers of particles known as cosmic rays. These are particles of high energy undergoing multiple collisions as they penetrate the air. All this was familiar to me from my research in high energy physics. But until that moment, I had only experienced it through graphs, diagrams, and mathematical equations. As I sat on that beach in meditation, my former experiences came to life. In a sense, I saw cascades of energy coming down from outer space, in which particles were created and destroyed in rhythmic pulses. I saw the elements around me and the elements of my body participating in this giant cosmic dance. I felt its rhythm and I heard its sound. And that at that moment, I knew that this was the dance of Shiva, the Lord of dancers worshipped by the Hindus. At that time, I had already become very interested in Eastern mysticism and had begun to see striking parallels to modern physics. I had been particularly attracted to the puzzling aspect of Zen Buddhism, which reminded me of the puzzles of quantum theory described so vividly in Heisenberg's book. At first, however, relating physics and mysticism was a purely intellectual exercise. It took me several years to overcome the gap between rational analytic thinking and meditative consciousness, to experience how the mind can flow freely, how spiritual insights come on their own without any effort, emerging from the depth of consciousness. The unforgettable experience of the Dance of Shiva was followed by many similar, though less powerful, experiences, and gradually I became to realize that modern physics leads us to a consistent view of the world that is in harmony with ancient Eastern wisdom. I took many notes over the years, wrote a few articles about the parallels I was discovering, and finally, I summarized my discoveries in the Tao of Physics, published first in London and in Berkeley in 1974. And I brought the two first editions with me to show you. So this is the first edition published by Wildwood House in London in 1975. And here you have the first American edition published by Shambhala, who were then in Berkeley, also in 1975. Now the book is available in over 40 editions, over 20 languages around the world. Now, at first glance, it seems strange that one could draw parallels between science and mysticism, because scientists and spiritual teachers pursue very different goals. The purpose of the former, of the scientists, is to find explanations of natural phenomena. The purpose of spiritual teachers is to change a person's self and way of life. However, in their different pursuits, both are led to make statements about the nature of reality that can be compared. Now, before I go into more detail, I need to say a few words about religion. The view of science and religion as a dichotomy has a long history especially in the Christian tradition, and has recently been revived in several books written by scientists, like Stephen Jay Gould, for example, or Richard Dawkins. On the other hand, there are many scientists who see no intrinsic dichotomy between science and religion, or science and spirituality. At the core of this confusion, in my opinion, lies the failure of many authors to clearly distinguish between spirituality and religion. Now, to understand the nature of spirituality, I find it useful to begin with the root meaning of the word spirit. As you know, the Latin spiritus means breath. And interestingly, this is also true for the related Latin word anima, or soul, and also of the Greek psyche and the Sanskrit atman. They all mean breath. So the common intuition in these ancient languages was that of spirit and soul as the breath of life. Spirit, the breath of life, is what we have in common with all living beings. It nourishes us and it keeps us alive. Spirituality is generally understood as a way of being that flows from a certain profound experience of reality, which is known as mystical, religious, or spiritual experience. There are numerous descriptions of this experience in the literature of the world's religions and in philosophical literature. And these descriptions all tend to agree that it is a direct, non-intellectual experience of reality with some fundamental characteristics that are independent of the historical or cultural context. In accordance with the original meaning of spirit as the breath of life, spiritual experience can be described as a non-ordinary experience of reality during moments of heightened aliveness. Our spiritual moments are moments when we feel intensely alive. And this aliveness, felt during such a peak experience, as the psychologist Abraham Maslow called it, involves not only the body, but also the mind. Buddhists refer to this experience as mindfulness, this heightened state of alertness. And interestingly, they emphasize that mindfulness is deeply rooted in the body. So spiritual experience is an experience of aliveness of mind and body as a unity. Moreover, this experience of unity transcends not only the separation of mind and body, but also the separation of self and world. The central awareness in these spiritual moments is a profound sense of oneness with all, a sense of belonging to the universe as a whole. This sense of oneness with the natural world is fully borne out by modern physics and, in fact, by modern science as a whole. However, this is not necessarily true for religion, and here it becomes important to distinguish between the two. Spirituality, as I said, is a way of being grounded in a certain experience of reality that is independent of cultural and historical contexts. Religion is the organized attempt to understand spiritual experience, to interpret it within a particular historical and cultural context, and to use this interpretation as the source of moral guidelines for the religious community. In many spiritual traditions, for example, in the various schools of Buddhism, the mystical experience is always primary. Its descriptions and interpretations are considered secondary and tentative, insufficient to fully describe the spiritual experience. In a way, these descriptions are not unlike the limited and approximate models in science, which are always subject to further modification and improvements. In the history of Christianity, by contrast, theological statements about the nature of the world or about human nature were often considered as literal truths, and any attempt to question or modify them was considered heretical. This rigid position of the church led to the well-known conflicts between science and fundamentalist Christianity, which have continued to the present day. Now, I should also say that fundamentalist attitudes are not limited to religious leaders. Scientists too can be fundamentalists, forgetting that all their models and theories are limited and approximate, and ignoring the important role of metaphor, both in religion and in science. Now, when that happens, the debate between scientists and religious leaders, fundamentalists on both sides, turns into what the French call a dialogue des sourds, a dialogue of the deaf. Now let me summarize the main thesis of the Tao of Physics. My main thesis is that the approach of physicists and mystics, even though they seem at first quite different, share some important characteristics. To begin with, their method is thoroughly empirical. Physicists derive their knowledge from experiments. Mystics from meditative insights. Both are observations, and in both fields, these observations are acknowledged as the only source of knowledge. Now, the objects of observations are, of course, very different in the two cases. Mystics look within and explore their consciousness at various levels, including the physical phenomena associated with the mind's embodiment. Physicists, by contrast, begin their inquiry into the essential nature of things by studying the material world. Exploring ever deeper realms of matter, they become aware of the essential unity of all natural phenomena. More than that, they also realize that they themselves and their consciousness are an integral part of this unity. And so the mystic and the physicist arrive at the same conclusion, one starting from the inner realm, the other from the outer world. The harmony between their views confirms the ancient Indian wisdom that Brahman, the ultimate reality without, is identical to Atman, the reality within. A further important similarity between the ways of the physicist and the mystic is the fact that their observations take place in realms that are inaccessible to the ordinary senses. In modern physics, these are the realms of the atomic and subatomic world. In mysticism, they are non-ordinary states of consciousness in which the everyday sensory world is transcended. In both cases, access to these non-ordinary levels of experience is possible only after long years of training within a rigorous discipline. And in both fields, the experts often assert that their observations defy expressions in ordinary language. Now, over the last 40 years, the Tao physics has been received with an enthusiasm that went beyond my wildest expectations. This tremendous response has had a strong impact on my work and my life. I've traveled extensively, lecturing to professional and lay audiences in Europe, North and South America, and in Asia, discussing the implications of the so-called new physics with men and women from all walks of life. Since then, I have written several more books. But still today, I encounter people all over the world who tell me, "I love your book," or "Your book has changed my life." And I don't need to ask them which book they mean. They always mean the Tao of Physics. Again and again, I have witnessed how this book and my lectures about it generate a strong resonance in people. And I've come to understand this enthusiastic reception in terms of the broader cultural context of my work. Again and again, men and women would write to me or would tell me after a lecture, "You have expressed something that I have felt for a long time but wasn't able to put into words." These were generally not scientists, nor were they mystics. They were ordinary people, and yet they were extraordinary. Artists, grandmothers, businessmen, teachers, farmers, nurses, people of all ages, just as many over 50 as under, and quite a few have been old people over 80 and in a few cases even over 90. So what did the Tao physics touch off in all these people? What was it they had experienced themselves? I've come to realize that the recognition of the similarities between modern physics and Eastern mysticism is part of a much larger movement, of a fundamental change of worldviews or paradigms in science and society, which is now happening throughout the world and which amounts to a profound cultural transformation. This transformation, this profound change of consciousness, is what so many people have felt intuitively over the last four decades. And this is why the Tao physics has struck such a responsive chord. During my lectures and seminars, men and women from all walks of life often told me that a similar change of paradigms was now happening in their fields. And this led me to expand my focus, and in my subsequent books, I explored the change of paradigms in various other fields, various disciplines, such as biology, medicine, psychology, economics, management, and so on. Now, to connect the conceptual changes in science with the broader change of worldview and values in society, I had to go beyond physics and look for a broader conceptual framework. And in doing so, I realized that the major social issues that we face, health, education, human rights, social justice, political power, protection of the environment, the management of business organizations, and so on, that all these issues have to do with living systems, with individual human beings, social systems, and ecosystems. And with this realization, my research interest shifted from physics to the life sciences. And over the last 30 years, I put together the broader conceptual framework that I was looking for, using insights from the theory of living systems, complexity theory, and ecology. It is a framework that integrates four dimensions of life: the biological dimension, the cognitive dimension, the social, and the ecological dimension. I presented summaries of this framework as it evolved in several books, and my final synthesis was published by Cambridge University Press in the book that David mentioned in his introduction, The Systems View of Life, A Unifying Vision, which I wrote with my friend and colleague Pierluigi Luisi. I now also teach an online course for the first time in my life, and I must say I enjoy this tremendously. It is based on my textbook, and it is called Capra Course, easy to remember, and you can easily find it on the internet. Well, with my change of perspective from physics to the life sciences, I now see future elaborations of the thesis I presented in the Tao of Physics, not so much in further elaborating the parallels between physics and mysticism, but rather in extending these parallels to other sciences. And in fact, this is already being done. After the publication of the Tao of Physics in 1975, numerous books appeared in which physicists and other scientists presented similar explorations of the parallels between physics and mysticism. Other authors extended their inquiries beyond physics, finding similarities between Eastern thought and certain ideas about free will, death and birth, the nature of life, mind and consciousness, and so on. Moreover, the same kinds of parallels have also been drawn to Western mystical traditions. Some of these explorations were initiated by Eastern spiritual leaders. The Dalai Lama, in particular, has held dialogues with Western scientists on numerous occasions. These extensive explorations of the relationships between science and spirituality over the past three decades have made it evident that the sense of oneness, which is the key characteristic of spiritual experience, is fully confirmed by the understanding of reality in contemporary science. And therefore, there are numerous similarities between the worldviews of mystics and spiritual teachers, both Eastern and Western, and the holistic or systemic conception of nature that is now being developed in several scientific disciplines. The awareness of being connected with all of nature is particularly strong in ecology. Connectedness, relationship, and interdependence are fundamental concepts of ecology. And connectedness, relationship, and belonging are also the essence of spiritual experience. I believe, therefore, that ecology, and in particular the philosophical school of deep ecology, is an ideal bridge between science and spirituality. When we look at the world around us, we find that we are not thrown into chaos and randomness, but are part of a great order, a great symphony of life. every molecule in our body was once part of other bodies, living or non-living, and will be part of future bodies. And in this sense, our body will not die, but live on, because life lives on. Moreover, we share not only life's molecules, but also its basic principles of organization with the rest of the living world. Indeed, we belong to the universe, and this experience of belonging can make our lives profoundly meaningful. Well, thank you very much for your attention.
Oh, thank you very much, Fritjof. Before we ask for questions, I think we'll ask you to speak clearly and slowly so Fritjof can hear us. But I'd like to mention one or two reflections, particularly because reading your book as an undergraduate physicist, it was quite a life-changing experience for myself. And I think it was because, you didn't actually touch on this when you said why you thought the book was important. And it wasn't anything to do with about the cleverness. And I think there's a lot of that, too much of that in the world. It was actually that you had a strong vision, a strong story. And I think probably I had been lucky in that just prior to reading your book, I think it must have been a first year undergraduate, I'd actually been and seen a water moderated nuclear reactor where you could actually see the neutrons interacting with the water and you get this beautiful pale blue glow from the radioactivity. So your vision of the cosmic dance and the sea, it certainly resonated very, very strongly with me. So what happened, of course, is that you then became, I suppose, a role model. And we need role models with strong visions, with strong stories in our world. So I wanted to personally thank you. So certainly from that moment as an undergraduate, and I was in fact only 10 miles down the road at Surrey University, I discovered we had a very large second-hand bookshop called Thorpe's, which I don't believe is there anymore. And you could walk miles down these passages, and I found my way to the mysticism section, which was quite extensive. And certainly a lot of my time, instead of reading physics books, was actually collecting different books on mysticism. So personally, I want to thank you.
Thank you. Very kind of you.
So, questions. Oh dear, have I? Right, we have some microphones.
Thank you very much for the very inspirational work. My name is Paul Kinevich. I wondered if you had any comments about, you talked about the relationship between physics and spirituality and mysticism. What about the relationship between physics and religion? By that I mean Western Christianity, Judaism, Islam, religions which are less experiential than what you've been talking about, in fact, in which experience is pretty much irrelevant to the practice. I wondered if you had any thoughts about correspondences that you've seen there.
Well, I think I addressed this in the lecture that to me it is very important to distinguish between spirituality and religion, because religion is always influenced by historical and cultural context in which the spiritual experience is interpreted. And in many religions, this experience then disappears completely, and what was first an interpretation becomes dogma. And so, you know, sometimes there are similarities between science and these dogmas, but other times they are not. But I don't find any coherent similarity between science and religion, whereas I find a very profound and coherent similarity between science and spirituality.
Hello, thank you very much for giving your talk. I wondered if you had any comments on people in the Western world who'd been labelled with schizophrenia. Is it possible that they might be experiencing a sense of interconnectedness and oneness with anxiety and distress?
Absolutely. And I have also written about this, believe it or not. There is a book of mine called Uncommon Wisdom. It's a very personal book of reminiscences of conversations I had with people who influenced me. And one of these people was the psychiatrist Adi Lange, whom I knew quite well. And I had many discussions with him about this very topic of your questions. What may there be a similarity between the experience of schizophrenics and the experience of mystics? And Lange, I still remember this verbatim, when I first asked him this question, he said, mystics and, he said, the mystic and the schizophrenic find themselves in the same ocean, but the mystic swims while the schizophrenic drowns.
How about the difference between the mystic and the schizophrenic is the mystic can integrate the experience?
Yes. I think that is correct. And this is why he or she swims in the metaphor of lying.
Thank you, John Capp. I wonder whether you could substitute the word system in your book, The Systems View of Life, for the word field. I'm very conscious that Rupert Sheldrake has written a lot about morphic fields, and Irving Laszlo about Akashic records. The way I read all those books are that the meaning, the basic fundamental meaning, your word system and their word field or record, is actually synonymous. Would you agree?
Well, I'm sorry, I wouldn't agree with that because, you know, in science, these words have very specific meanings. A living system is, for example, a living organism. Now, a living organism includes a material structure. A living organism is very different from a field. A field is defined as a condition of space in which certain objects feel certain forces. And this is not what a physical structure, a biological structure, like an animal, a plant, or a human being is like. So I think they are quite different.
Jeremy Slaughter, the views that have been expressed today have been quite positive about the idea of spiritual evolution and humans participating in a generally upward evolutionary process. In that context, what would you say from a systems perspective about what's happening in things like Brexit and the recent election of Donald Trump and the associated phenomena?
Well, this is a big leap from physics and mysticism to Donald Trump and Brexit. But let me try. One of the reasons why I find systems thinking so important to deal with the problems of our world is that these problems are all interconnected and interdependent. Whether we talk about energy, the environment, poverty, violence and war, economics, and so on, all these problems are systemic problems, which means that they cannot be solved in isolation. They need corresponding systemic solutions. Solutions that solve a problem within the context of other problems. Now, in our book, The Systems View of Life, about half of the book is theory and the other half is applications. And we list literally hundreds of systemic problems that have been solved with systemic solutions. So, coming to, say, Donald Trump and the people who promoted Brexit, they do the opposite. They have a narrow view of identifying a problem and putting forth false solutions. And they would say, for example, that the economic hardship that many people felt in the wake of economic globalization, which was led by corporations to the detriment of individual workers, families, and communities, they would say that these hardships all came from Brussels. And if we just get our independence from the EU, these hardships will disappear. So this is a false populism. And Donald Trump did exactly the same. Donald Trump said, you know, I will help the simple people to get over their problems. I will bring them jobs. I will bring them more wealth and so on. And then, you know, after he was elected, he filled his cabinet with billionaires who were the initial cause of the economic problems and will make things much worse. So, this is a striking example of narrow-minded false solutions. What we need is the broad systemic solutions to the problems of our time.
Frischhoff, it's Bernard Carr here, and I think David referred to the meeting in Trinity in 1977 where I invited you to talk.
Right.
It's great to hear you talk again.
Yeah, and I still remember I had a room in the tower where Isaac Newton had his room. So this was a big thrill for me.
Absolutely, and you've been following in his footsteps. But I would like to make a point about Tao Physics, because obviously it was a pioneering book which had a huge impact, and of course, especially in this room, it's filled with admirers who were influenced by that book. On the other hand, there is another side to the story, and that is the fact that I know not all physicists approved of this book. And even today, I read accounts from physicists very negative about these attempts to try and forge a link between physics and Eastern philosophy, etc. And indeed, the same antagonism towards any attempt to link physics with mysticism, which is certainly for myself, is not fair. But so I would like to ask you, well, first of all, I'd like to say you were also very brave in writing that book, because you must have known you would attract some flack from the physicists. So one question I'd like to ask you was, did you expect that you would get flack from the physicists, and how has that attitude changed in since the publication of the book? And I then want to ask you another question, which is slightly more technical. A lot of your book was originally, I think, linking the bootstrap model of Geoffrey Chu to Eastern ideas. Now, of course, the bootstrap model isn't so popular in physics. So I wanted to ask you, if you were writing the book today, would you slightly change the emphasis because of that? So two rather different sorts of questions.
Okay, well, thank you, Bernard. The first question, absolutely, I was aware that these attempts of linking physics to mysticism would find a lot of opposition. And much of the opposition in the early days was expressed in terms of ridicule. And people, just laughed about me and made jokes and so on. And I was very well aware of that. And I actually, had to drop out of physics to write the book for 4 years because I wouldn't get financial support for writing the Tao of Physics from a science foundation or from a college or university. And however, this has changed quite dramatically. And what happened after the book was published was first that my colleagues realized that the physics in the book is correct. In all these 40 years, there has not been a single person pointing out an error in how I describe physics. So they respected that. And physicists know, high-energy physicists know that to explain our theories to lay people is not easy. And they appreciated that. So I got a lot of appreciative comments from my fellow physicists. They didn't buy the mysticism, but, they appreciated my presentation of physics. Now, in subsequent years, they saw that the book was so tremendously successful, and then more and more physicists began to write similar books. And today we can say there are two generations of books that came after the Tao of Physics. And so things have changed quite a bit. And I want to tell you a personal anecdote, which is very typical of that, and which I've not published anywhere. So when I wrote the Tao of Physics, just in the time before, I was working in London at Imperial College. And my boss there was Abdus Salam, the famous physics Nobel laureate. And I got along with Salam very well, and I did work on some of his theories. But after about 2 years, he said, "Fritjof, I'm very sorry. I can't support you any longer because you're doing this philosophical work and we don't really have the money for that. And, I need the space of your office. So I'm very sorry, but I have to ask you to leave." So essentially he threw me out in a very friendly way, but still he threw me out. Well, about 10 years later, Salam was interviewed by an Italian magazine about his Center of High Energy Physics in Trieste and about his ideas of the nature of physics and so on. And the interview asked him, "By the way, do you know Fritjof Capra and his book, The Tao of Physics?" And Salam said, "Oh yes, I know Fritjof very well. In fact, he wrote his book in an office next to mine." So he associated himself with my book. Rather than saying I threw him out, he said he wrote the book in an office next to mine. So you see, this, the attitude has really changed quite dramatically. Now, Bernard, to your question of the bootstrap model, I have thought a lot about this in the last few years, and certainly I would write this chapter differently now. However, my thinking is the following. The great problem in particle physics and unsolved problem is to build a theory which is called theory of everything of the four main forces of nature, strong nuclear force, the electromagnetic force, the weak interactions, and gravity. And the first three of those have been unified in a theoretical framework known as the standard model. The last one, gravity, has resisted this unification for decades and decades. The most popular candidate is string theory, the most widely pursued approach, but it has huge problems. And there are many critics that say it is not really a theory because it can't be tested. There are many versions of it, and you can't distinguish between them, and so on and so forth. And they have they're tremendous problems. Now, some people believe, and increasingly people believe, that the reason why string theory has a problem is that it assumes a framework of space and time as given, the framework of Einstein's general relativity, and then it sort of places the other phenomena within that framework. And this is a contradiction to relativity theory, which says that space, time, and matter are mutually dependent. And so people say that as long as this separation is not overcome, we will not find a solution to the problem of connecting gravity with the other phenomena. Now, this is precisely what Geoffrey Chu and the bootstrap theory did, to overcome this separation and to integrate space and time into what we call the bootstrapping of the whole. So I now believe that the bootstrap philosophy and bootstrap approach will reemerge in some form or other to solve the problems of string theory. And it would be too much of a technical discussion to go into details. But Bernard, I'd be very happy to correspond with you and give you some more of my ideas.
Thank you, Richard. I would be happy to do that. And thank you for answering both my questions so in such great, interesting detail. I love the story about Salam.
Yeah. Hello, Marilyn Monk. Thank you very much for your lovely talk. During your talk, you were saying that science and mysticism share the same empirical method, experiments in the material world in the case of science, and insights from, say, peak experiences or and so on from mysticism, and that the two approaches, the two empirical approaches, came to the same conclusions. I can understand the same conclusion being involved with interconnectedness in systems, the experience of interconnectedness, and also the interconnectedness that we are clearly aware of as scientists in all systems, even if we have to have one variable at a time sometimes. Could you just elaborate, and you're saying you're extending those conclusions coming from science and mysticism, physics and mysticism into the human sciences and biological sciences. So I'm very interested if you could enlarge upon the conclusions in addition to the interconnectedness in systems.
Well, basically, there are two very basic themes that I see running through modern science. I see two basic themes running through modern science. One is the fundamental interconnectedness of all phenomena, and the other one is the fundamental dynamic nature of reality. And this is very strong in the life sciences, where in biology, every structure is the result of underlying processes. And for to understand biological structure, we have to understand biological processes, biological forms. So my integration of these dimensions of life that I mentioned before actually has four perspectives on life. One is the perspective of matter, the traditional perspective of physics and chemistry. The other one is the perspective of form, where you talk about patterns, the perspective, say, of complexity theory and things like that. Then there's the perspective of process, and this is where cognition comes in as the process of knowledge. And then there's the perspective of meaning when we come to the realm of human consciousness, where we have consciousness, culture, and meaning. And so these themes run through all of modern science, and these are also the basic themes that run through spiritual traditions. Okay.
Just one more question, okay? You mentioned about the four forces in physics, which everybody is aware of. My yes. feeling, there is one very important force that is missing in this physics, which is our intention or will, both for human being but also in the universe. Do you see intention or will also as a force which can influence the universe? I can show you. Do you see, this is my will. Because of my will, it's going up, okay? But it's not any one of the physical force that you mentioned. So is will or intention is also force in physics, yes. Will or intention is also force in the universe, which is neglected by physics.
Yeah, no, I see will and intention as part of consciousness, which emerges from cognition in evolution. I see mind or cognition as being part of life at all levels. And as living organisms become more and more complex, their cognitive processes become more and more complex. And at a certain level, consciousness in terms of self-awareness emerges. And that's when we also get will. I don't see this as a property of the universe as a whole.
I think we will, since we're having some technical problems, I think perhaps we'll finish this session now, because we can't see you, Fritjof. We just want to say a really fantastic thank you. I think this is why I love the network, because we can talk about life, the universe, and everything. So we had from Shiva to Trump, to Brexit, to systems thinking, consciousness, the theory of everything. We really have gone round the universe and back again. So, Fritjof, you've done us proud. We're really, really grateful. So thank you very much for joining us for our conference.
Thank you. It has been a great pleasure. It was a great pleasure. And I must say that in spite of some technical difficulties we had, still this human contact, even via electronic transmission, is very impressive and very enjoyable. And I wish you a very good rest of the conference. Thank you.
Thank you very much.